Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. Welcome to episode 7 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. Today we're going to be finishing up our viruses, right? So we've had 2 episodes on viruses, and we're going to have this last episode, and I'm also going to cover the high yield or commonly tested information relating to the fungi on the exam, okay? Congratulations to all the fourth years that matched yesterday. If you did not match, it's not the end of the world. There are just many options you can take. Try to speak with the dean at your med school or speak with someone that's knowledgeable with the residency process. There's many options available. Try to explore those options, and I wish you the best going forward. Okay, so let's begin. So discussion of the hepatitis viruses, right? So A through E. And we're going to discuss some key factoids relating to all the viruses, and then we'll discuss the Hep B serologies, right? So clearly there are 5 kinds of hepatitis viruses, right? There's Hep A through E, okay? And in previous podcasts, we've talked about how A and E on the ends of the hepatitis alphabet, just like your mouth and your anus at the 2 orifices of your body, okay? So they are transmitted in a fecal-oral fashion, okay? So Hep A and E, fecal-oral transmission, they have no envelope, okay? The other viruses, the other like Hep B, C, and D, they are actually all enveloped viruses, okay? And remember that Hep A and E both cause acute infection, okay? They do not cause chronic infection. For Hep E, right, so E as an egg, you want to remember that it's extra virulent in pregnant women, right? Remember, in pregnancy, you're in a relatively immunosuppressed state, okay? So you have an increased risk of getting more virulent infections. That's why obstetricians are usually super, super, super on top of their game with regards to treating any infections in a pregnant female, okay? And again, if they give you a question about a person that had like jaundice and they had right upper quadrant pain and they were pregnant and they passed away, think about Hep E, okay? Think about Hep E. Now, for Hep C, right, the classic association will be a person getting like an IV drug user or a person that got a transfusion and then they present with jaundice. And they have like right upper quadrant pain and they say, oh, you obtain serologies and you'll find antibodies against Hep C, or you have a positive Hep C RNA. If you see that, again, think about Hep C, right? So classically on exams, it's associated with transfusions and stuff like that. And remember that unlike Hep B, where like 90 to 95% of people recover from an acute Hep B infection and do not go on to chronic infection, people that have Hep C, about 80% of them that have an acute Hep C infection actually progress to having a chronic infection. It so happens that there is now treatment for Hep C. It just costs a lot of money. And I'll discuss that pharmacology in a separate podcast when we go over the drugs used in microbiology. Okay. Now, for Hep D, think of Hep D as being the dependent virus. Okay. It basically needs the Hep B surface antigen from Hep B. Okay, so if a person gets a Hep D infection and they don't have Hep B, they're totally fine, okay? But if you have a Hep B infection and a super infection with Hep D, you're like super screwed, okay? So basically, the big thing you want to remember here is that if a person has vaccination against Hep B, okay, they cannot get Hep D, okay? So just something to keep in mind. Now, for Hep B, right, so like I've said, most people that get the infection, about 90 to 95% of them recover, okay? But there's one exception to that, and those are infants. Infants that get Hep B infection, about 90% of them progress to getting a chronic infection, okay? And one thing you want to keep in mind is if they give you an exam question about a lady that has like poor prenatal care, blah, 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 and then she delivers a kid, and then they tell you that, oh, the mom's Hep B surface antigen is positive, and a Hep B core IgM is positive, blah, 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 and then they ask about the next step in management for the kid, okay, you want to make sure you give that kid the Hep B vaccine, okay, and then you also want to go ahead and give them the Hep B immune globulin to give them some kind of passive vaccination. That's a very common exam question. Okay, so let's sort of talk about some of these Hep B serologies. But before going to the serologies, let's just talk about what the markers mean. If you really understand what the markers stand for, it's super easy to answer many of these exam questions. You really should not be missing these exam questions if you've studied this stuff. So the Hep B surface antigen, basically, Whenever it's positive, you have disease, okay? There's one exception to that, the window period we'll talk about in a bit. But if your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you certainly have disease, okay? And if that Hep B surface antigen is present in your blood, it's detectable for more than 6 months, then you do have chronic Hep B infection, okay? If the surface antibody is positive, it could mean one of many things, right? It could mean you've gotten the vaccine, or you've recovered from a past infection, and we'll talk about what that means in a bit. Okay, if you have the core antibody positive, it tells you that you've been exposed to actual Hep B, right? So you could be well, or so you could have like a past resolved Hep B infection. It could also mean you're currently infected. Okay, and if you have a Hep B core IgM, it shows that you have acute infection, or you're in the window period, okay? But if it's IgG, it shows you have a chronic infection, or again, you've been exposed in the past, you recovered from it, okay? Remember, IgG is more of a long-term marker that, oh, okay, this person did not get this infection over the past like 1 to 2 months. If your Hep B E antigen is positive, it means you have very high infectivity, okay? And the window period is just one of those high yield things you wanna know. That's basically where the Hep B surface antigen sort of counterbalances the Hep B surface antibody pretty well, okay? The only thing that is positive in the window period is the Hep B core antibody, okay? Classically on exams, it's IgM. So let's discuss the different phases and talk about what will be positive. And to be honest, it really doesn't make much sense to discuss what's negative. If you know what's positive, and that's the only positive thing in the chart you get on your board exams, you should be able to reason this out. So for acute Hep B infection, right? So obviously, if you're infected, the thing that's always positive is the Hep B surface antigen, okay? And your Hep B core antibody will also be positive. Classically, it's IgM, okay? Lower yield serum marker you want to know is the E antigen. The E antigen will be positive in an acute infection, especially if you have very high infectivity. Now, if you have a chronic infection, again, if it's not resolved, your surface antigen will be positive. Okay, your core antibody, IgG this time, would also be positive. Okay, if you have a chronic infection and you're not very infective, your Hep B E antigen will be negative. If you have high infectivity, your Hep B E antigen will be positive. And then, like I discussed earlier on, the window period, the only thing that will be positive is the Hep B core antibody, okay, the IgM. And if you've had a prior infection and you recovered from it, your surface antigen would not be positive because you don't have disease, okay? The things that will be positive will be your Hep B surface antibody, okay? And your Hep B core IgG, okay? Those will be the only things that are positive if you had a prior infection. And then if you've been immunized, the only thing that will be positive is your Hep B surface antibody. There's nothing else that is positive, okay? The vaccine does not include the core antigen, so you do not make antibodies against that. Okay, if you know these serologies, you should always, like, these are one of those questions where you can always get the answer right, because they just usually make it relatively straightforward. If you learn the material, you get it right. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. Bilateral facial erythema in a child, stillborn fetus with generalized edema. Okay, so hopefully you're thinking of the slapped cheek rash. This is classically caused by Parvo B19. Okay, remember, it's the only single-stranded DNA virus you do need to know for your exam, okay? And just a quick word on the DNA viruses, right? Because we've discussed them in previous podcasts. But remember that all the DNA viruses, they replicate in the nucleus. The only exception to that is the pox virus, okay? And all the DNA viruses are icosahedral, okay? They have an icosahedral shape. Okay, just one of those things you want to know, because your friends at the MBME, they'll classically give you questions, you're like, oh, slap cheek rash, I know the answer, it's Parvo B19. And then you're looking for Parvo B19 as an answer choice and it's conspicuously missing. And all you see is like, oh, icosahedral, single-stranded DNA, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, seriously? So just things to keep in mind, okay? These viral morphologies and their genomic structure, those are generally high yield for the exams, okay? So Parvo B19, okay, it's a single-stranded DNA virus, causes in adults, it can cause like arthritis and myalgias and all that stuff, but they really test that. The thing they classically test is the congenital Parvo B19 infection, okay? Because it so happens that PARVOB19 loves to infect erythroid progenitors. And when you infect those progenitors, you do not make red cells, okay? So the kid in utero can get like a very severe aplastic anemia. And when a kid has anemia, the kid can go into high output heart failure, which we discussed in the in a previous podcast. And that high output heart failure can, if the heart fails, you can basically have like edema everywhere because the heart is not pumping blood forward, okay? And there is also some problems with like extra like hematopoiesis in like other organs and all that stuff. But the big thing you want to remember is hydrops fetalis with congenital PARVOB19 infection, okay? And if they also describe a kid with a hemoglobinopathy, right, so like sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia major or whatever, and they tell you that this kid has a severe anemia, and they tell you about the slap cheek rash, right, again, you want to think about PARVOB19, okay? Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about that. Let's go ahead and move on to the next slide. So a 33-year-old female presents with a one-month history of postcoital bleeding. That's not good. Well, postcoital bleeding may be normal, but we need to push further. So, colposcopy with biopsy reveals cells with enlarged nuclei and perinuclear vacuolation at the basal third of the cervix. So, what's the bug? Okay, so we're potentially worried about a cervical intraepithelial neoplasia with this. Okay, so the thing I'm getting at here is HPV. Okay, it's HPV. And HPV, there are certain high-yield things you want to know. I mean, first things first, it's a DNA virus, okay? It's a double-stranded DNA virus. But you definitely want to know the serotypes, okay? So there's like HPV-1 that tends to cause plantar warts, okay? There is HPV-6 and 11 that tends to cause genital warts. The $5 word is condyloma acuminata, okay? Please do not confuse the condyloma acuminata of HPV 6 and 11 with the condyloma lata that you get in secondary syphilis, okay? Those words sound similar enough for people to confuse them on exams. Do not be one of those people. And then HPV 16 and 18 and the HPVs in the 30s all cause cervical cancer, okay? They can cause cervical malignancies, so that's something to keep in mind. So classically, any female that's between the ages of 9 to 26 should get the HPV vaccine, okay? And I'll just, as a sidebar here, I'll highly encourage you, for a woman, every year, just go for your well woman visit. There are so many things that are preventable in the land of OB-GYN if you just get checked out regularly, okay? So that's just my public service announcement. Probably when we discuss some male stuff, I'll also have my sidebar for the guys. Okay. So it's vaccine preventable, right? So there's like the Gardasil vaccine that covers the really nasty HPV serotypes like 6, 11, 16, and 18. That's the Gardasil vaccine. And another way they can present HPV on your exam is to basically tell you about a person where they say, oh, this person has like these raised lesions, like varicose lesions in the perineal area, or they describe the cervical lesions I mentioned, and then they say on microscopy, you see these enlarged nuclei with perinuclear vacuolation. Okay, this is basically a description of the coelocytes you find in HPV. Okay, remember they look like fried eggs, just like we observe in an oligodendroglioma. Okay, so that's just something to keep in mind. The thing is, your friends at the MBME, they may not necessarily give you the fried egg appearance in a Q-stem. They may describe what you see. Okay, that's one common MBME exam strategy. They take what you know and just put it in a different language, right? So the classic example I cite with students when I'm teaching is I talk about how they describe sarcoma bodies as laminated calcifications. Okay, so just sort of things to keep in mind with that. Okay, so how does HPV cause problems? Well, the big problem with HPV is it produces certain proteins, E6 and E7. In fact, E6 is sort of involved in the ubiquitination pathway, so that's a very nice cell biology tie-in. And another nice cell biology tie-in is that these two proteins, they basically inhibit the RB gene and P53, Okay, and when you inhibit those tumor suppressor genes, you have a propensity to have uncontrolled cell proliferation, because cells can go from like the G1 to S phase willy-nilly, and you can get into trouble with that. So that's certainly something to keep in mind. Very nice cell biology tie-in with HPV. Okay, next slide. So a 10-year-old male who recently swam in a pool at a business retreat for all the executives, that's firm, with other kids, presents with a 4-day history of diarrhea and red urine. He has a sore throat and bilateral watery exudation from his eyes. So what is the bug? Okay. For this question, I basically gave you all the exam hooks. Okay. So this is clearly adenovirus. Okay. So if they describe a kid with like gastroenteritis that has pink eye, and they talk about like having a sore throat, right? So like pharyngitis. Think about adenovirus. Okay. Adenovirus is the virus that classically causes pink eye, okay? And because it's a viral cause of conjunctivitis, you want to think of it, you want to think of the person's eye having more of a watery exudate, okay? It's not usually like thick or purulent, like you observe in bacterial conjunctivitis. And you may also have thought like, what if, could this be strep pyogenes, right? So like group A strep pharyngitis. Group A strep pharyngitis on exams does not present with conjunctivitis, okay? So that's something to definitely keep in mind. So the buzzword for adenovirus is pharyngoconjunctivitis. Pharyngoconjunctivitis, so sore throat plus pink eye, okay? And occasionally these kids can also present with a gastroenteritis, okay? Another thing they can present with is hemorrhagic cystitis. So if they describe a kid that has red urine, and they recently had an upper respiratory infection, and maybe like conjunctivitis, you really want to think about adenovirus, okay? So read the Q-stem carefully, because they may try to trick you with post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, which, as you know, has an association with group A strep infection, okay? And also has an association with red urine, okay? So you need to read the question carefully, see the different hooks they give you. If they give you conjunctivitis, you probably want to think more of a hemorrhagic cystitis. Okay, and other associations, basically the big things I wanted to discuss here are other causes of hemorrhagic cystitis, right? So remember that schistosoma hematobia can also cause a hemorrhagic cystitis. They can classically describe this in an exam question relating to Egypt. So if you see Egypt in an exam question and a guy has blood, red urine, like blood in his urine, think about a schistosomiasis, okay? Schistosoma hematobia. And remember the drug cyclophosphamide also causes a hemorrhagic cystitis because of its nasty metabolite, acrolein. You can prevent that by giving Mesna, okay? You could also actually give N-acetylcysteine to prevent that. Okay, now, so I think that's all I'm going to say about adenovirus. I forgot. Most common cause of viral gastroenteritis is the Norwalk virus, okay? Remember, it's a Khaleesi virus, so just something to keep in mind. Okay, so vomiting and diarrhea on a cruise ship. C. diff preventive strategies, right? So cruise ship gastroenteritis, I hope you're thinking about the Norwalk virus, okay? It's passed along through the fecal-oral route. So again, vomiting, diarrhea, cruise ship, think about the Norwalk virus. It's also called the norovirus, okay? And the way you prevent the spread of this virus is actually with hand washing, okay? A classic MBME exam question is a person that has a post-antibiotic, watery, foul-smelling diarrhea. You know that's C. diff, okay? And they ask about how the spread of this infection could be limited in a hospital. Okay, you want to go ahead and explore hand washing. They will try to give you an answer choice that says to use like alcohol sanitizers. Don't do that. Alcohol sanitizers do not take care of C. diff. It is only washing your hands with soap and water that takes care of C. diff. Okay, next slide. Farm worker presents with a mix of hyper and hypopigmented skin lesions on the trunk and back in the summer. So what is the bug? Okay, what is the bug? So hopefully you're thinking about Malassezia furfur, okay? I should probably have put a picture of this. Maybe I'll try to finagle one and put it in the final slide. Let me make a note to myself. So Malassezia furfur. Okay, so Malassezia furfur, right, causes tinea vesicula, okay? And the way you make the diagnosis is with a KOH prep. And classically, when you get a KOH prep, you'll see something described as a spaghetti and meatball appearance. Okay, and really treating Malassezia furfur, you just need to take a topical selenium sulfide, just rub it over the skin, wash it away for like a week, and boom, it goes away. Okay, so Malassezia furfur, tinea vesicula, spaghetti and meatballs, selenium sulfide for treatment. Those are the big things you want to remember. Okay, next slide. Now, 10-year-old male presents with a pruritic lesion on the left upper extremity. The lesion appears coin-shaped with central clearing. This lesion fluoresces on the Wood's lamp. What's your diagnosis and what's the bug? Okay, so this is ringworm. Okay, the medical term for ringworm is tinea corporis. And basically, the tineas are caused by a group of fungi known as the dermatophytic fungi. Okay, don't confuse dermatophytic fungi with dimorphic fungi. We'll talk about dimorphic fungi in a later slide. Okay, dermatophytic fungi. And the bug I'm actually going after with this question is Microsporum. There are three kinds of dermatophytic fungi, at least that you need to know for your test. There is trichophyton, okay? There is microsporum, and there is epidermophyton. In general, trichophyton, they test it on exams in the context of tinea capitis, okay? It causes a lot of if you look at a picture of tinea capitis, it's pretty striking when you see it online, but it causes tinea capitis. Ringworm can be caused by any of the dermatophytic infections, okay? But if they give you the qualifier that the bug on fluoresces on the Wood's lamp, think about microsporum. Or if they even add a dog association to the question, think about microsporum, okay? Now, just other discussions with the dermatophytic fungi. So we've talked about the causes: microsporum, epidermophyton, and trichophyton, okay? Tinea capitis is like the thing you get on the head. Tinea unguium, right? That's the thing you get on the nails. Okay, so like toenail fungus, that's tinea unguium. It's also called onychomycosis. And one thing I will say with all these things is that in general, these are dermatophytic fungal infections. You treat them with topical antifungals and they go away. But on your exam, if they describe a person that has toenail fungus, or the person has tinea capitis, they will give you answer choices that say like some kind of topical antifungal, and then they'll give you an answer choice that talks about some oral antifungal. Pick the oral antifungal. Classically on exams, it's either terbinafine or griseofulvin. Okay, you need the oral stuff to treat the dermatophytic infections that involve the hair and involve the head and the nails. Okay, so tinea capitis and tinea unguium, you treat those with oral griseofulvin or terbinafine. Remember that terbinafine is the thing that I believe inhibits it's squalene epoxidase. We'll talk about that when we get to the antimicrobial pharmacology. And remember that griseofulvin is an inhibitor of cytochrome P450. Okay. Hang on. Griseofulvin is actually an inducer. Sorry, I take that back. It's an inducer of cytochrome P450. Sorry about that. Okay. So, next slide. This patient was pricked by a thorn while taking a walk in his friend's garden. This person should not have taken a walk in his friend's garden, but no, I'm just kidding. But basically, this person has a sporotrichosis, okay? This is one of the dimorphic fungi. So this is Sporothrix schenckii. It's classically described as Rose Gardner's disease, okay? So if you get a question about a person pricked by a thorn, and then they have these lesions that sort of appear in a single file on an extremity with lymphadenopathy that may or may not be painful, think about Sporotrix schenckii, okay? And really, the way you treat sporotrichosis is with itraconazole for months. You classically need to give itraconazole for like 6 to 9 months to get complete healing of the infection. And if they also describe that, oh, they did a KOH prep and they found a cigar-shaped yeast, okay? Also think about Sporotrix schenckii. Next slide. 19-year-old college student presents with dyspnea and a mild fever 1 week after returning from a field trip to the Mammoth Caves in Kentucky. So if you notice, I'm beginning to give you questions with pictures. Believe me when I say that these pictures are not here for show. They're actually important. I will say that these dimorphic fungi I'm about to talk about, a lot of them are classically tested on exams with the pictures in the QSTEM. So it's just something you want to keep in mind. Although I will say this, most of the pictures on the MBME exams are not very useful for answering questions. But if you could recognize the picture, a question could turn to an auto-click question, okay? Where you spend like 10 seconds and you move on. Okay, so this person has histoplasmosis, okay? So histoplasma capsulatum, okay? This picture you're seeing, you're basically seeing macrophages, and they have these intracellular yeasts, okay? So that's the big association you want to know. You definitely want to know your geography with this one, right? So the Ohio, Mississippi River Valley, and if they describe a person that went spelunking, right? So that's the buzzword. Like a person went exploring a cave, and they were exposed to like bat or bird or poop. Think about H. capsulatum, okay? Basically, what happens is you walk into a cave, just like every other human being, bats and birds, they also have to poop. And when they poop, if you inhale those things, you can basically contract H. capsulatum, okay? And H. capsulatum, it classically causes an interstitial pneumonia. And one unusual question, so here's one thing, right? So it causes an interstitial pneumonia. You do perform a chest x-ray. You find interstitial lesions like ground glass opacities and all that stuff. But one unusual question they could ask on exams is a patient that has HIV that lives in like Ohio or Kentucky or the Mississippi River Valley, and their CD4 count is less than 150, and they ask for the next best step in management. They could basically present a person that's totally asymptomatic, but CD4 count less than 150, lives in Kentucky, next best step in management. Your next step in management for that person is to potentially prescribe prophylactic itraconazole, okay? It's one of the guidelines. If a person has histo and they live in a susceptible area, so not every HIV person that has histo, not every HIV person that lives in the US or in the world, but a HIV person that lives in a susceptible area, right? So like Kentucky, Ohio, Mississippi River Valleys, and the CD4 count drops below 150, next step in management, classically on exams, is to give them itraconazole, okay? The magic number you want to remember is 150, okay? And while we're doing that, let's just quickly run through some other CD4 numbers for HIV patients, right? So if the CD4 count drops below 200, right, you want to prophylax against pneumocystis jirovetsi, okay? You can use TMPSMX, so trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole. You could use dapsone, you could use aerosolized pentamidine, and that should work, okay? Now, if the CD4 count drops below 250, okay, you want to go ahead, and the person lives in a susceptible area, right? So like Arizona or Texas or New Mexico or Nevada or California, and the CD4 count drops below 250, you want to prophylax against coccidioides immitis, okay? Also with itraconazole. Now, if a person's CD4 count drops below 50, you want to prophylax against Mycobacterium avium intracellulare, okay? Remember, it's an acid-fast bug, okay? And your prophylaxis is with azithromycin. Remember, azithromycin is a macrolide, okay? So just sort of a quick review there for you. Okay, so I believe we're done with this slide. So let's go ahead and move on to the next one. So slide 10, a 19-year-old college student presents with a non-productive cough, mild fever, and painful erythematous lesions on the shins bilaterally. The roof of his home in California was recently blown away by a countywide typhoon. Okay, so hopefully, with this picture, right, you can see this well-placed spherule in the center. This person has coccidiomycosis, right? So classically caused by coccidioides immitis, okay? So again, if you see the buzzword spherule in a sputum culture, again, think about coccidioides immitis, okay? Remember your geography, like Arizona, so the southwestern United States, right? So like Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, California, Nevada, okay? Things to keep in mind. And on exam questions, they could also describe like some kind of natural disaster that disrupts the earth, right? So like an earthquake or a typhoon or a really bad storm or whatever, okay? And the person lives in these susceptible areas and begins to present with pulmonary symptoms, and they say, oh, a chest x-ray shows interstitial infiltrates. Think about coccidioides imidus, okay? And one of the high-yield clone exams is the presence of something known as erythema nodosum as a dermatologic finding, okay? So the thing is, erythema nodosum classically presents on the lower extremities, and they classically describe it as a painful red lesion. Painful red, well-circumscribed lesion, lower extremities. Think about erythema nodosum. It has a very strong association with coccidioides imidus. Okay, in fact, coccidioides imidus, they call it like desert rheumatism. Basically, the findings are like you have these pulmonary symptoms, you have erythema nodosum, and then you have like very severe arthritis. Okay, and if you're told about an African American female that has erythema nodosum, what is the very first thing you want to think about? Well, I'm hoping you're saying sarcoidosis. Okay, that's a very big association as well in sarcoidosis. Sarcoid is one of those diseases that classically affects African Americans, females, has erythema nodosum as a dermatologic finding, and has anterior uveitis as an ocular finding. So those are just very nice tie-ins you want to see with sarcoidosis. We'll probably talk about it in a later podcast. Okay. And I've said that if a person has HIV, they live in a susceptible area, CD4 count is less than 250, prophylaxis with itraconazole. Okay, now, next slide. So this slide says a resident of Missouri presents with a two-week history of a non-productive cough and multiple ulcerating skin lesions on the upper and lower extremity. This is sort of a non-specific question, so they almost always give you the picture on exams, okay? You can see these broad-based budding yeasts, so this is blastomyces, okay? The geographic association, again, is like the Ohio Mississippi River Valley area, and if you look at the phoneme of the bug, blastomyces dermatitidis, right? So derm tells you it causes a lot of skin problems. The skin problems it causes classically are ulcerations, okay? So something to keep in mind. Now, so I guess we can go ahead and move on to the next slide. So patient with a past history of active TB presents with hemoptysis. Upright chest x-ray is notable for an upper lobe lesion that changes position when a decubitus film is obtained. Okay, so upright chest x-ray is notable for an upper lobe lesion that changes position when a decubitus film is obtained. So I hope you're thinking of some kind of fungus ball with this question. So if I say fungus ball, what do you say back to me? Aspergillus fumigatus. Okay, so this is an aspergillus infection. If you also look at the picture, you can see the angles, right? So these are bugs, okay? They grow at, you basically see hyphae, they grow at 45 degree angles, okay? And these hyphae have septa, okay? So septate, 45 degree angle hyphae, think about aspergillosis, okay? And aspergillus can present in many ways on your exam. Right, so it can present as allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, right? So if they describe a farmer, okay, that maybe has inhaled like some animal stuff or some like barley stuff, whatever, and they describe all these pulmonary symptoms, and they say, you do a blood culture or you do like a sputum culture and you see the hyphae, septate hyphae, 45 degree angles, you really want to think about aspergillosis with that, okay? Just one weird, bizarre association that you may never see on step one, but if you saw it, you'll be grateful that you listened to this podcast is, if they describe a farmer that has, or a person that plays with birds or whatever, that has pulmonary symptoms, and they say like, oh, you're not necessarily seeing any bugs, and the question is like very non-specific. One thing you want to think about is something known as a thermophilic actinomycetes, okay? So if you don't see like aspergillus, for example, also think about a thermophilic actinomycetes. I will look that up if I were you on Wikipedia. It's just one of those bizarre things that every now and then, for whatever odd reason, shows up on exams, okay? So that's just something you want to keep in mind. Now, another presentation of aspergillosis, like I mentioned, is the fungus ball, right? So classically, a patient with a history of TB, those calcifications, like the upper lobe calcifications you get with TB, aspergillus can invade those things, okay? And classically, that will present as hemoptysis, okay? So that's something you definitely want to keep in mind. Now, another patient population where aspergillosis may be tested with regards to your exam is a patient that is neutropenic. Okay, so patient with severe neutropenia, another patient population could be someone that has a history of CGD, okay, so chronic granulomatous disease. Remember, that's an NADPH oxidase deficiency, and remember the testing for that is the nitroblue tetrazolium test, right? Those people will have a negative NBT test, right? And one thing you want to keep in mind is, why does a patient with a history of CGD get aspergillus infections? Well, the thing is, aspergillus is catalase positive. Okay, so remember, people that have CGD tend to have recurrent infections with catalase positive organisms. Okay, so that's a very high yield tie-in you want to keep in mind with that. And the way you treat aspergillosis is you can give voriconazole, okay, or you can give amphoterol, right? So amphotericin B. I'll talk about all those drugs in a later podcast. Okay, next slide. So, a 32-year-old female who was recently treated for lobar pneumonia presents with severe vaginal and perianal erythema. A cottage cheese discharge is seen on vaginal exam, right? So if you look at these pictures, these things look like germ tubes, okay? So classically on exams, these talk about like pseudo hyphae showing up as germ tubes at 37 degrees Celsius. You really want to think about Candida albicans, okay? So candidiasis. So Candida can cause many kinds of infections, right? So classically, like a female without risk factors, and they just say, oh, she recently had some kind of antibiotic treatment for some infection, and then she presents with like a cottage cheese vaginal discharge and a lot of itching and erythema around the perianal area, think about candidiasis, okay? Remember that Candida albicans also causes thrush and esophagitis in an AIDS patient, right? So you treat that with like the Nystatin swish and swallow, or swish and spit, whatever floats your boat. Remember that Candida classically does not cause a specific shape of ulcers in esophagitis in an AIDS patient, right? So remember, CMV is the one that causes the linear ulcers, and HSV is the one that causes the punched out ulcers, okay? There's no classic ulcer description for esophagitis with Candida, so they classically on exams have to give you like some kind of thrush association, or they describe what you see on KOH prep, okay? The germ tubes, 37 degrees Celsius, okay? And again, cottage cheese vaginal discharge in a female, think about Candida. Classically, the vaginal pH is less than 4.5. That's something you definitely want to know, okay? Because if you contrasted that with Gardnerella vaginalis that causes bacterial vaginosis, and Trichomonas vaginalis that causes like the strawberry cervix with a frothy greenish discharge in a female, those infections are associated with a vaginal pH greater than 4.5, okay? But for Candida albicans, the pH on exams is usually less than 4.5. So that's a very high yield association you want to keep in mind, okay? And in patients that are obese or have like diabetes, if they describe like red lesions on the like skin folds, you want to think about Candida as well, okay? Like itchy red lesions on the skin folds. You could get that from Staph aureus, but you could also get that from candidiasis, okay? And then if a person has like invasive Candida infections, think about a patient that probably has like the George syndrome, okay? Basically, any T-cell disorder, like a T-cell deficiency disorder, would increase your risk of getting invasive candidiasis, okay? So like SCID, severe combined immunodeficiency, where you have an adenosine deaminase problem or a problem with the interleukin 2 receptor, think about invasive candidiasis in those people, okay? So, next slide. Fever, nuchal rigidity, and papular edema in a patient with a CD4 count of 93 who runs a pigeon farm, okay? This patient has AIDS. They probably should not have been running a pigeon farm, okay, because they have a cryptococcosis, okay? So this is caused by Cryptococcus neoformans, classic exam picture. You have that on the slide. And remember, this is a yeast, okay? It's an encapsulated organism, right? So it's one of those high-yield organisms that has a capsule, okay? So it would potentially give you like a positive reaction on a Quelong test. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And this bug has an association with pigeon droppings, okay? So remember I said bat and bird droppings, think about histoplasmosis. Pigeon droppings, think about cryptococcosis, okay? In fact, this is the most common cause. Very high yield to know that it's the most common cause of meningitis in an AIDS patient. And classically, you on exams, they talk about the India ink stain. That's not super sensitive. The thing most people do now is the latex particle agglutination assay. Okay, so that's something you want to keep in mind with cryptococcus. And how do you treat cryptococcosis, right? So you give amphotericin B and you give a drug known as 5-fluocytosine. Okay, remember 5-fluocytosine, it can be activated by cytosine deaminase to 5-FU, which goes ahead to inhibit thymidylate synthase in the bug. Okay, that's actually how 5-fluocytosine works. We'll talk about 5-fluocytosine and other antifungals in a later podcast. Okay, so next slide. 33-year-old male has been in the ICU for the past 7 days. He was rushed to the hospital by ambulance after he was found obtunded by a close friend at home. CBC/BNP on admission showed a blood glucose of 300, pH of 7.13, and a bicarb of 13. Oops. He has been recovering from over the last 3 days, but begins to complain of severe facial pain in a maxillary nerve distribution. Okay, that's cranial nerve 5, okay, the second branch. Over the next few hours, he begins to drain black, foul-smelling material from his nostrils. Okay, if you ever see a patient that has this presentation, you really shouldn't spend too much time on these questions. Also, look at this picture, right? These are 90 degree angles, and we do not see any septa, okay? So this is mucormycosis, right? So classically on exams, the bug they test is rhizopus, okay? So this is mucormycosis. Has a very strong association with like rhinocerebral infections, right? So like necrotic sinusitis with infections in the brain in a patient that has diabetes, okay? In fact, I will say, you can almost guarantee that on exams, the only people that will ever get mucormycosis are patients that have elevated hemoglobin A1Cs, okay? It's a very high yield association you want to keep in mind, okay? So this is mucormycosis. The only thing you can do for these people is, one, give them amphotericin B, and two, debride the necrotic tissue. Most people die, okay? But the only people that have ever survived are people that got amphoterrible, okay? So that's all I'm going to say about that. So let's go on to the last slide. We've talked about this bug many, many times, but I'm just going to hit it home again to round this up. Okay. So patient with a CD4 count of 45 presents with a 1 week history of shortness of breath and a non-productive cough. Temperature is 100.9. Chest X-ray is notable for bilateral interstitial infiltrates with a ground glass morphology. LDH is markedly elevated. What's your diagnosis and what are the other associations with this bug? Okay, so this picture should be something you're used to. Okay, I will tell you that this is something that was derived from an induced sputum sample, right? So like by bronchoalveolar lavage, for example. And these organisms are silver stain positive in a HIV patient with pneumonia, interstitial infiltrates, chest X-ray. What are you thinking about? Pneumocystis jervetzi. Okay, so PCP. Okay, remember PCP, it's silver stain positive. That's definitely something you want to know. On almost every exam question you'll see this on, they will talk about the LDH being elevated. Okay, the people that get these infections on exams are classically HIV positive patients, but if they want to mess with your brain a little, they can give you a person that has a history of like some autoimmune disease or a transplant and they need to be on chronic immunosuppression. Those people can also get PCP pneumonia, although that's usually more of a step two thing, okay? And remember, on a chest X-ray, you'll see an interstitial infiltrate ground glass appearance, okay? Ground glass appearance. And the magic number you want to remember with PCP pneumonia is a CD4 count less than 200, okay? Once a patient has HIV, CD4 count is less than 200, you want to prophylax with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or dapsone or aerosolized pentamidine, okay, to prevent PCP pneumonia. Okay, and again, they describe a HIV patient has a pneumonia and the O2 sats are like in the 80s. You should have a very good reason for not picking pneumocystis jervetzi on the exam. But I'll sound a warning with that. If a person has HIV and they present with a productive cough, a very high fever, okay, and they tell you that chest x-ray shows a lobar consolidation, they will try to trick you on the exam to pick pneumocystis jervetzi. Do not be one of those people. Go ahead and pick Streptococcus pneumoniae, okay? So, PCP does not cause a lobar consolidation on exams, okay? It causes an interstitial infiltrate on exams, okay? And again, the way you treat PCP pneumonia is you give trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. If the person is severely hypoxic and they're going into respiratory failure, you classically also go ahead and add IV corticosteroids to their treatment regimen, okay? So I hope you've gotten something from this. If you understand this podcast and the other podcasts on viruses, you should be able to answer most viral questions you will find on your board exams. And if you also went through these cases, you should also be able to answer with confidence most of the fungi questions you'll see on your board exams. I am going to make a few podcasts that are dedicated to the antimicrobials. So we'll talk about those drugs in a later podcast. So I wish you all the best. Congratulations again to the awesome fourth years that matched. And I hope to see you guys on the wards in the future. Thank you.